If you want success, change how you keep score. That's the topic of today's talk. All of us want success, and it's not necessarily defined the same way for each of us, but if we can redefine it and redefine how we keep score, our chances of being successful and having all the good feelings that come to somebody who feels successful is a lot greater. There are a lot of different scales of measurement out there. You know, we talk about the English system and pounds and inches and so on, and the metric system, centimeters and meters and grams and kilograms. But I suggest that we're going to want to look at a different scale of how we judge our behavior. I think if we can shift away from a scale of perfection, which is impossible to attain, and instead switch to a scale of effectiveness, we're going to be a lot better off. We're going to be a lot more compassionate, a lot more accepting of our human behaviors. I suggest, for simplicity's sake, that draw a horizontal line about 5 inches long, put a zero on the far left, 100 on the far right, and mark the midpoint as a 50. And this represents the scale of effectiveness. We're always going to be effective to some degree. I don't think we're going to achieve 100, nor do I think we'll ever fall down to a zero. We're going to be more or less effective in everything we attempt to do or attempt not to do. And it's, if we are somewhere above the 50% point to, say, 75 or so, and recognize that the game is to increase our effectiveness, then we're going to be a lot more forgiving. And it'll be a lot more fun to do things and to try to learn and to have different experiences. And so if you look at that and say, well, how will I know where I am on the scale of effectiveness? Judge your feelings. Look at your feelings and say, oh, I feel good about what I just did, and that is more effective. So put yourself above the 50% point. And no matter what it is you do, even if I happen to be standing at this moment, if I decide to sit down and I go to sit down and I miss the chair and in fact hit the floor, you could say, wow, that's zero effectiveness. I disagree with you. You can look at it and say, the guy had a thought. That's effective. He made a decision. That was effective. He took action. That was effective. And he discovered where the chair was not. He discovered how not to land on the chair as he's sitting down. And that knowingness that I attained from that final step may serve me at some point where it is really important to me to have that awareness. So you could say, well, that missing the chair was not the level of effectiveness he was shooting for at that moment in time. You go, yep, I would agree with that. However, if it serves in the future to be more effective, then that is a good thing. I think we can start to look and judge our way we measure ourselves, and we're going to be a lot happier with ourselves. This falls into the same kind of category, if you will, that we need to overcome what I call the management by disapproval. Management by disapproval is a very common behavior. We experience it. We're told as children that if we do a certain thing or don't do a certain thing, we're going to make somebody else unhappy, and that will earn us disapproval. We're told about God disapproving of human beings because of Adam and Eve, and we're told that teachers disapprove of somebody who's unruly in class or who asks questions, who acts out, and on and on and on. We can see this thing being displayed, this management by disapproval, into adult ages. Bosses disapprove of employees and vice versa, and customers disapprove of companies and employees or customer service people, and it goes on and on. We invest a lot of energy into this behavior of disapproving, and it doesn't make us feel better. Consequently, it moves us away from effectiveness. Consequently, it moves us away from the success we're looking for. Balance is an overlooked essential in a successful life. Now, we can look around and see the greatest people in the world in a particular context. Say, Tiger Woods as a golfer. You could look at his life and go, it wasn't really balanced. But, on the other hand, he became so exceptional as a golfer because he devoted an extraordinary amount of time and energy into the activity of playing golf. We have now recognized that that degree of out of balance may have resulted in people start to label him the greatest golfer ever before he actually surpassed Jack Nicklaus, but his out of balanceness, if you will, showed up in his sexual behavior, his infidelity to his wife. He clearly didn't see that as an area that he needed to balance. He didn't see his role as a husband in a balanced fashion. And maybe it's true of all the greatest people that have to devote or want to devote or decide to devote their attention to one particular activity, climbing Mount Everest and doing any single thing, that other stuff doesn't get the attention that would lead to a balanced life. There's no problem with that as long as we understand what we are doing when we sacrifice balance. We're setting up what I would consider to be some sort of a rubber band effect. You know, you stretch a rubber band, you stretch it, and then you let go of it, and that snaps, and it can sting and hurt, and there's going to be a reaction to that. So as long as we understand that that's going to happen, maybe it's not so difficult for us. But when we don't realize it, and we don't recognize that balancing work and play is an important idea, or balancing investments of time, energy, attention, and money is an important idea, or balancing activity and rest is important, or balancing taking with giving is an important idea, or balancing reaping with sowing is important, and balancing our own self-interest with the self-interest of others is important. If we don't understand that, we're setting ourselves up for conflict. We're setting ourselves up for a particular reaping of a harvest that is probably not going to be to our liking. The two main impulses of individual life, and this information comes from Christ Returns, reveals startling truth. Those two impulses of individual life, bonding and rejecting, and it's fully explained in the book, and it's an absolutely fantastic book, and this is a fantastic set of concepts too. Makes sense that if our lives are being governed by these two impulses, bonding and rejecting, you would think, I wonder if in order to be successful, it's a good idea for me to understand these two concepts. Like, if your life is being governed by something, it pays to understand how to work in harmony with these ideas instead of being at effect of them, to be the victim of them, not only of your own display of bonding and rejecting, but when other people act out these impulses. If you look at bonding as the acquisition of what we want, and in this culture, acquiring things is the usual measure of a success. The person with the most is considered to be the most successful. Oh, he's got the most money, the most cars, the most this, the most that, the highest, the greatest title, the biggest home, right? That's how we see things as a general rule. And so in our culture, the pressure to get things is enormous. I want to get this, I want to get that, I want to get that. Our advertising on television and elsewhere is really geared to creating these desires that I got to get this, I got to get this now that I've seen that ad or that picture or that read that story. I've got to get it. People literally work themselves to death trying to get things. They get on this treadmill and boom, they don't get off until they fall off dead. Because things, material, right, solid, you can tap them, you can touch them, you can see them, and numeric, it's easy to see or to tabulate or to calculate these kind of objects or these concepts, we like to be able to touch things and to count things. And those things are particularly appealing to us, and they're very effective when it comes to being marketed to us. It's easy. Oh, yeah, I can see it, I can see it. I can count it. In the measurement of success, you know, we either think these questions in our own minds or we speak them aloud, but we talk in terms of how many or how much. Kind of like that quantity is really the way to judge somebody and their value, how successful they are, how many of this do they have, how much of that do they have. All of those things drive people to have a lot of this and a lot of that. We're thinking, and to an extent this is certainly true, that when measurement time comes, you know, the answers, how much, and we can say, oh, I got, you know, millions, or I've got dozens, or I've got five, or I got whatever it happens to be, whether we're talking about children, grandchildren, money, cars, you name it. We think that those answers are going to be attracting positive attention to us, and maybe even admiration. People go, ooh, they got this much of that and that many of this. Ooh, that's successful. However, it doesn't come as any surprise to an adult, and it probably to any child above the age of reason, that human beings will go to extreme measures to get the things that they want. We do amazing things to get what we want. On the negative, we can see greed and theft and rape and revenge and murder and all kinds of behaviors on that far end of the scale of what we try to do to get what we want. On one end, those extremes of bonding, got to take it from somebody else no matter what the consequences, or on the other end, this rejecting of another person to the point where we kill them. Those things are being practiced all over the world. Those two impulses to the extreme are common all over the world. In our culture, sports are a big deal. A lot of people play games, and some people, including myself, refer to life as a game. But look, let's just look at sporting events. All sporting events have measurements using numbers. The numbers are for calculating points or runs or goals or baskets or and measurement of time. You know, how much of this can you achieve in this particular time period? That's essentially what games are about. And there are certain things that say you must not do this, right? They're against the rule. Those are illegal. Those are fouls. Those are not appropriate to do. And certain things that you are allowed to do. You know, you have permissions to do certain things. You can throw a ball forward, you know, that sort of thing. You get this many strikes up at bat before you're called out. So all of these structures to the game are normal to us. We think really nothing of it. For most people, games start out in childhood as being about fun. Oh, this is fun. Let's play this game because it's fun. It's fun. But as we get older, then the games get more competitive. That means there needs to be a loser while we become the winners. We need to make somebody else lose so we can be judged the winners. And now all of a sudden, this, we're going not for fun, not for that vibration of feeling good, but we're going for some sort of admiration or other attention or other energy forms that are connected to be the winner. And so attention, which all of us need in order to live, you can look at it as a positive energy flow. But in terms of a sport, the person with the best score is going to get positive energy from the fans, from newspaper, from, you know, publicity, from the announcers and from other people. And you could say, that attention, that was the energetic purpose behind the game initially, and it was going to be fun, but now all of a sudden, the purpose of having fun is way overlooked. And so the energy we want are bigger contracts, more fame, endorsement deals, all related to money and power and influence and positive attention from an adoring or even a hating public. I suppose it seems like some people are shooting for attention that is given to us by others is really important. It's really important. And one of the things that's not really recognized initially is that it validates that we exist as an individual. We exist as an individual. Why? How do we know that? Because the other person looked at us, spoke to us, interacted with us, exchanged energy with us, either was kind to us, was unkind to us, but the fact of the matter is, they proved that we exist. The need to have our individual existence noticed and approved of is huge. It's huge. You've probably heard of the idea of groups, religious groups, shunning a member for breaking a rule. They no longer exist in our eyes. And those people can literally die from being disconnected from their group, from their tribe. You go, wow, that's... their existence just got invalidated. And if they take it seriously, it can be fatal to them. We will do, as human beings, many things to get attention, to satisfy this need for attention, for validation of our existence. Ideally, I think what we start out with, we'll do positive things. We want to be loving, and we want to be useful, and we want to be kind, and we want to be good, and so on. But if that doesn't work, over time, if we're not going to be successful at producing positive attention, we then start to revert to negative attention-getting techniques. And then we experience all kinds of different things in society, inside of a family. It'd be interesting, and I suggest you do this, both for yourself and for other people, is to notice when, in a conversation with somebody else, the tendency is to make that conversation about us. I find this to be interesting. I see the impulse in myself, and I see it in other people. It's like, it's a beautiful day today. This is one of the nicest days I can remember. And see what happens to somebody else if they go, well, I had an experience of an even nicer day when I was in Bora Bora, Pago Pago, or you name it. And all of a sudden, everything seems, in many situations, to be, there's a tug of war going on. Let me make this about me. Oops, she's making it about her. Oh, no, he's making it about him. And it is this, in our individual self-interest, to have this energy flow, this attention, giving and getting, which for some of us think, oh, no, the way to be successful is get all the attention all the time. I don't think so. Certainly people who can promote seem to end up with a lot of money because they can say, I'll say, outrageous things. You know, the Dennis Rodmans of the world or the some of the people who will get up there and just make unbelievable statements and just keep going out. Politicians do this all the time. You just go, wow, that's not a normal person making a statement like that. But they get the attention, they break through the clutter of energy, and there they are, now being fed attention. If you look at your own tendencies with regard to trying to become successful by getting attention in these circumstances, you go, I suggest you do that for yourself and other people, but think in terms of attention deprivation, right? Almost like a thirst. If we didn't get attention in a reasonable fashion as children, then there's a likelihood of one or more things, one of which is we act like we're still thirsty for attention. I gotta get it. Or, it's like, it's hopeless. I already tried that when I was a kid. It's hopeless. I'm not gonna be able to get it. And so now we withdraw into ourselves. So those two extremes, that look at me, see me, notice me, validate me, versus the other person who is like stays in a shell. When we look in those kind of circumstances where we're in a group of people talking, and it's like I'm trying to get attention from a person who's trying to get attention from me, who's trying to get attention from another person who's trying to get attention from, and we're all like trying to get what we believe to be this limited amount of attention. And that can be a problem. If we think success comes from how much attention we get, we're keeping a score in a way that only a few people are going to be successful at. If you think being on the front page of a newspaper represents success, there are a limited number of people that are going to make it to that status. That can be changed. These attention-seeking, energy-seeking tendencies, I think, can be said to be aligned with our personality types. My wife, Mary Ann, in her consulting practice, has used for years this personality testing system that's pretty straightforward, easy, and very, very helpful, called DISC. D for dominant, I for influential, S for steady, C for conscientious. They're all good. They're all different in terms of how they interact with other people, how they get attention, what makes them feel good, and what happens when they don't get their way. And it's real, real interesting to be able to look at this. And so if you were to say that a D in some circles is considered to be a doer, a driver, or a dominant, it's a person that needs to get stuff done. So their attention will come from getting things done. They'll be physically active. They'll be doing. That's the way they move. That's the way they process information. And it's perfectly fine. An I-type personality, influential, is different in that they will do a lot of talking. They will interact. They're social people. People are important to them because that's where attention comes from. So they'll be talking about it. An S-type personality is a calmer person, a rescuer, somebody who tends to placate situation. They're a peacemaker. They're trying to steady the situation and keep things from getting out of control. They try to calm the waters. They don't like storms and so on. So their energy is that. So their personal need for attention really is kind of limited relative to the other three personality types, although all of us have all four of these, just a question of how much of each. They tend to want to keep things in balance. Good thing to have. And then the C is a conscientious, or a person who's very information-oriented. And this personality is, I would say, feels safer the more information they have. The more knowledge they have, the more stuff they know, the safer they are. And so a lot of their attention comes from, I know this and I know that, and what about this? And so they use that information as a form of not only self-protection, not only as a way to create, but also how to get attention. They need to know a lot. When our attention in childhood, family of origin, was real negative, then you could say, I don't want attention. And you're trying now to, I'll say, for some of us have this reality of walking on eggshells, trying not to be noticed, not to make waves, not to wake the sleeping saber-toothed tiger or provoke any kind of negative response from our environments. Now, all of a sudden, with this hopelessness of being able to create what we want, have our existence validated positively, we're pretty much restricted in two different directions. We're either going to be angry about that because of this natural need for attention, and it's natural and it's good, balanced, it's good, and that depression is when we believe it's hopeless. So now we're putting the brakes on something that is just such a natural drive in human beings. There's a real problem. In human society, you know, we can see that there's a lot of emphasis put on labeling. You know, the marketing companies, pharmaceutical companies, all companies are trying to label things so that they can market their products and make them understandable to other people, or said it maybe more accurately, make them attractive to other people. But we carry over the labeling to other people. And we label some people as acceptable, some people as not acceptable. And so now, if you're labeled not acceptable, your chances of achieving success, if you're using the system of rules established by the people judging you not acceptable, I would say you're really disadvantaged. The Old Testament, for example, and the Jews who wrote it, labeled the Jews as the chosen people. I wonder if that's any surprise, right? People who write the history write it very glowingly of themselves. You know, all the conquerors, I was a good guy. I killed all those people for their own benefit, and I made society, fill in the blanks. That's been going on since who knows when, and it's still continuing to this very day. We use all of that. We label people, and we put it out there, and we excuse and overlook that the law of cause and effect is really in action. It's really happening. It's very predictable. It's inviolate. It happens every time, all the time. But instead, if we can change the rules and pretend it's something else is happening, for instance, in the Old Testament, God was defined as punitive and judgmental and smiting kind of a God. And so now their behaviors that they were reaping, they could overlook that as being the cause. No, I didn't cause it. I didn't cause it. No, you know, it's God doing it. You know, who can figure out that person? Whew, that's the way he is. And then they would turn around and sacrifice innocent things like animals and ultimately a man in an effort to appease a god. It's like, what kind of god needs a sacrifice of a dove or a lamb or a camel or a goat or another person? We would consider that today unbelievably primitive in thinking. But the way the game was scored, the way the tilting of the playing field occurred, that's what happened. So how do we measure success in America? I'll speak about America, but I think this is the West, generally speaking. Maybe not completely. This is it. I got about 10 items here. This list probably can go on endlessly. Number one, how do we measure success in America today? Number one, money. Number two, the ability to make money. Number three, having a lot of things money can buy. Four, the ability to influence people. Five, the ability to get what we want. Six, the ability to keep away what we don't want. Seven, attention in the form of power, fame, and if we can provoke jealousy or envy, that's okay too. 8, an extravagant lifestyle. 9, the number of people who need our approval and our okay. And 10, the control over other people. And you go, well, you might want to quibble with some of those, but by and large, I think you probably wouldn't. I think this is true. That game that I just listed, those success factors, I think the game and the playing of it are rigged and tilted. The playing field is tilted. You know, this simple idea that if you want to buy a house for $200,000 and get a mortgage for $200,000, that by the time you repay that loan, you're going to have paid for two houses. You're going to pay approximately $400,000 for that $200,000 home. And you go, that, now that I think of it, that's kind of excessive, isn't it? Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It's excessive because it's rigged. The game is rigged, and it's been rigged so the average person is disadvantaged in paying much more than they should. But when you're paying much more than you should, guess what you're not doing? You're not acquiring the means to become self-sufficient. You're paying twice for your house, and now that money, that other $200,000 that's going in interest, is not going into creating your own business or creating other things that are important to you, for you and your families. The more materialistic a person or a group is, the more they grab. And when you look at the banking and Wall Street and the pharmaceutical companies and a bunch of other, you know, the Halliburtons and other people in Comcast, a thing that's just happened recently, is AT&T with these mergers that these folks are talking about, they're grabbing more and more and more. If you haven't recognized it already, what seems very clear to me is we've lost our democracy to corporations. And we complain about the immigrants, but that's bogus. That's bogus. You know, 100,000 people or 1 million people or 2 million people or 4 million people, these people are tremendously disadvantaged. They're not really the enemy. It is the people who are consolidating all the factors of success as it's currently defined and that disadvantages us if we want to play the game the way it's been defined. If you look around and say, well, how is it this playing field is so tilted and stays that way? Because the people, the corporations with the money, like Comcast, for instance, has bought lawmakers. They recently hired a person who 4 months earlier voted in favor of allowing them to merge with another company, where there was a lot of public outcry saying it was unfair, it was tilting the playing field in telecommunications even further to the disadvantage of the public. And this, here it is, 4 months later, this person gets hired as a high-level person. She sold us out back then, and then she got hired. She worked for the corporation before she worked for the corporation. She didn't work for us when she was working for us. That game is rigged. When you recognize the game is really rigged, when they have more, they, and we have less, and over the years you look at the consolidation of income in America, wealth in America, and you recognize that it's gravitating to fewer and fewer people, and while the great majority of people have less and less, and you go, how did this occur? Because they're hardworking? Or no, because they have successfully tilted the playing field, rigged the game, and kept it that way to their advantage. So you just go, wow, I'm never going to be successful because I'm playing at a game that I don't stand a chance. Well, right now, the playing field is tilted against us. We have gravity, social and cultural gravity, right? Well, educational gravity, or legal gravity, or the lack of support. All of those things, you go like, wow, I'm really at a disadvantage. Well, what this really does is tell us we need to redefine this whole game. We need to redefine it in terms of today it's money, stuff, and power. And if we could redefine what we're seeking individually to consciousness enhancement, and everybody has access to that. Everybody has access to that. There is that field, that game is not closed. Anybody, any age, has access to consciousness enhancement. Those are the people that buy into that, have a chance for a level of success that these money grabbers or power grabbers or corrupt politicians and so on, thieves, are not going to have. As long as money, stuff, and power are thought to be the real goals of the game of life, we're all going to be like lemmings rushing to our deaths in pursuit of those things. I got to get it. Yeah, but you had 9 heart attacks. Yeah, but I got to get it. Not workable. However, if we can each redefine what is valuable to us, what is valuable to you, what is valuable to me, and they don't have to be the same things, but better you should be making those decisions for yourself and me for myself than having the corporate advertiser on television telling me what's important to me. I know they're telling me who my enemies are and all the bad things and who the good guys are, which I doubt, seems pretty obvious. But if we can decide for ourselves what's valuable, then we can decide on what we want to devote our lives to, our time, our energy, instead of running in this herd onto the treadmill. And if we can make these decisions for ourselves, we're going to have taken greater control of our lives. Right now in America, there are multiple trends, and I don't consider them necessarily positive, but generally, they're, you know, kind of like wave movements, if you will, maybe tsunamis, maybe smaller level waves, about the way people live and think and feel and act. And because these are a little bit more dramatic, we tend to notice them, and here are just an arbitrary list. The idea of consumerism, that is, you really, in order to keep the economic machine working, buy more, consume more, buy more, discard more into the landfills, and then buy more still. That's a big thing in this country, more than any other country on the planet. And when a trend is need more medical care, need higher cost medical care, gotta have it. And, you know, that there's a disadvantage there. war posturing, you know, with all these enemies, North Korea, Libya, Syria, Iran, all of these things are stirred up. And so what is the average guy doing? Is be hunkering down thinking that the sky is falling instead of recognizing all of this stuff is manipulated for the purposes of consolidating power, money, and influence. This stuff is all manufactured. And certainly the marketing of enemies, right? Now, the Republicans, it's the government is the enemy. The government is the enemy. I've even heard politicians, Republican politicians, say government is the enemy. And I'm looking at the guy and going, well, you're a case in point. Yeah, I agree with you. And then taxes are demonized like they're the worst thing in the whole wide world, taxes. It's like, oh, the government's taking your taxes. Taxes are it's the price of admission to play the game of living in America. But nope, we've made them enemies in Iran and immigrants and Muslims and blacks and Mexicans and on and on and on and on. Vitamins, you know, alternative health are the enemy. All of this stuff. Another trend that is terrible, it's terrible, but is underappreciated is the chemicalization of our bodies and the planet. Mad cow disease was not caused by what the cows were eating. It was caused by the chemicals that they were exposed to. But that because of the power of chemical companies, it's like, whoa, that's not going to happen. That was blown away, and they created a false cause that people got all upset about. And the consolidation of money and power that I was talking about, and economic instability and loss of homes in America, destabilizing. You take a group of people and you remove them from their homes, you make them rootless, you make them disconnected from a place, you've got people who are severely disempowered and easily controlled and managed. When people get on the consumerist treadmill with help from advertising, and especially if you got children and they're seeing this, I got to have those sneakers and that Game Boy and that toy and that thing and that clothing and that on and on and on and on. Once you get onto that treadmill, very difficult to get off. Although, over the last some years, there's been a trend toward simplification. Do I really need all that stuff? And people are arriving at the conclusion, no, they were tricked into it, but in fact, it's not that necessary. One material desire can lead to another until all time and all effort, all money, are used in the pursuit of more money to buy more things, leading to almost no satisfaction or happiness other than perhaps a momentary relief of related to the acquisition. What is important? What is valuable? What should we strive for? Where should we invest our lives in pursuing? What is the target? I like this from Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth, the truth of existence. I think we could use the truth of existence for our new game of life. In it, Christ says that divine consciousness, God, is and has designed the world so as to provide everything necessary for our existence, hence the phrase truth of existence. Those 9 items: growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, rhythm, all within a framework of spiritual law and order. It's there for us. It's like, well. And then if you add this other concept that I just absolutely love, is God is working for us, in us, and through us. So, wait a minute. If the truth of existence, these 9 things are important to life, and God is providing them for me, and working in me to make me receptive of them, and working through me to make them available to other people, not only my family, but clients and customers and friends and associates and strangers on the planet, what I have to do is support the idea that they would experience growth and nutrition and nourishment and healing and protection and fulfillment of need and work and survival and rhythm, all within the same framework of spiritual law and order. I should get them and work to have them play that same game. I should make this same blessing available to them as is available to me. And you go, wow, that wouldn't that all of a sudden change things? If you thought that that was your job, to help other people experience the truth of existence and that which we believe is behind creation. Yeah, that's what I want to help you experience. I want to help you experience. Now all of a sudden this ego-grabbing, rejecting behavior where we take all we can without regard to anybody else and push other people out of the way, now all of a sudden we would have a different experience entirely and go, oh, now all of us, this is a valid concept, it certainly makes sense to me to think of myself as a cell in the body of God. Don't I want to be harmoniously connected to other cells in the body of God? As compared to, no, I just want to be an isolated cell in a mansion with guard dogs and, barbed wire around the perimeter with all this stuff. It's like, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. We want to be harmoniously connected to other cells in the body. Otherwise, we'll have a planet like we're currently experiencing. I think this is a whole different ball game. To be able to look at that and see, yeah, now this makes a lot of sense to be able to harmonize with other people. Balance our self-interest with other people's self-interest. Their participation and experience with the truth of existence in our own. There's a fantastic statement that I think could change the way we play the game and can make us more successful than we ever imagined possible. And it comes from Letter 6 of Christ Returns on page 261 of the book. Your true purpose in life is to gain the mastery of your ego by reaching out in thought and feeling to that which you sense is behind creation and consistently asking for enlightenment. Christ goes on to say, this is the very first step a person must take toward the glorious moment when he or she will make contact with the divine and then move forward by means of continuing cleansing of the ego drive to the re-entry into that heavenly state out of which your soul was born and took its individuality. Our true purpose in life is to gain the mastery of our ego by reaching out in thought and feeling to that which we sense is behind creation and consistently ask for enlightenment. And that kingdom of God that Christ refers to, it talks about that being within. It is our soul connection to divine consciousness and describes it as healthy and prosperous and loving and kind and without any of the normal human suffering that we have accepted as part of being alive in a human body. He says it is not necessary. It is not necessary. We can redefine success by accessing the truth of existence, becoming aware of that power behind creation, and continually and consistently seeking enlightenment. We can work on our own awareness. Nobody can limit that. That playing field cannot be changed by anybody else. It is always level. Every one of us has full access. Our chances of being successful, to me, hinge on our willingness to become aware of our relationship with divine consciousness. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know that it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.